Oh, but the wind is about to blow something way up.
Okay, so we are recording now.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm Linda. I'm an alcoholic.
Editor. I'm Clark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clark. Okay, this is Conversations, and today we're going to talk about step one.
Step one.
All right. So I guess the best thing to do would be to give us a little bit of your background.
Well, it's scattered. 63-year-old, grew up in Dallas, Texas. We didn't have any problems growing up. I discovered alcohol about age 13, and yeah, I had one friend in the neighborhood, and he was the same age, and neither one of us could get alcohol, so we discovered going up and down the alley behind people's houses. The garage in everyone's house faced the alley behind the house, and we discovered that everyone who had a refrigerator in their garage, often that's where they kept their beer, out in the refrigerator. So we sneak in the garage of people's homes and help ourselves to the beer that was out there in their refrigerator. And started out drinking like a lot of old winos end up in an alley. And one time there was, maybe it was around holiday season, there were a lot of bottles of champagne and cold duck. And so we grabbed as many as we could, and as many as we could carry, and sat out there in the alley and shake them up and pop the cork and spray it on each other and pretend like they had
Champagne.
just won the Daytona 500 or something, like people did. And get good and drunk. And that champagne made me good and sick too. I had to make up some stories to tell my parents when I got home. And
How old were you when you started all that?
13,
Okay.
I think 13. And then David was killed in a motorcycle wreck 2 years later. And then I was alone and didn't really have any other friends. And that was one of the first traumas of my life that I remember, was losing David. And I realized that the alcohol helped. And I think one of the very first red flags that I probably should have seen was if we had a bunch of beer taken from a refrigerator, and if there was ever any extra left over, and for guys just starting out their drinking career, we often have a little bit left over. We'd hide it in the bushes or under a garbage can or something out in the alley, and I'd go home and I couldn't get it off my mind that beer was out there, and somebody's going to find it. Is it hidden well enough? I was worried about it. And then all day the next day at school, all I could think about was, man, I better get out there. I better be the first one to it, or somebody's going to get it, and they'll drink it and it'll be gone. And it just occupied my mind, obsessed. I guess it was the first sign of obsession about it. And so I would. I'd get out there, be the early bird, and get to the beer before anybody else. So I don't think there wasn't any question about being powerless over alcohol at the time. It didn't enter my mind, anyone's mind. Well, this is what we intend to do. We intend to sit here and drink and get the effects of it. That was the purpose of it. Nobody thought about I should regulate, or I only want to have a couple. Hell, we thought the person who drank the most was kind of a coolest. And so that's what we do, sit there and try to drink more than the other. Then we'd brag about, man, I drank so much. Well, I couldn't even remember. Well, yeah, I blacked out or nothing. And I hadn't had a blackout yet, but I had claimed to even before I ever had, because we thought it was the coolest. And the progression began, and it took more and more to get that happy feeling. And could sit out there and laugh. And I think there were times that I'd just be under its domination, whether it set my temper off, and then I'd get angry about something that otherwise I wouldn't even have given a flip about. But being under the influence of it, then I might get angry and not getting my way. And those were early signs of that.
Okay. So how old were you when you started thinking you were an alcoholic?
Yeah, that didn't come until I began to realize now something didn't right. I'd piss the bed just about every time I drink. And you couldn't drink that much beer and without that happening. And my belly would just be distended. It had so much, like a thumping on a water bottle. And what goes in has got to come out. And I try to stay, I try to keep myself awake because I knew it was going to happen. And I keep the TV on. I try to stay up late because I knew if I went to bed, then I couldn't do it. I'd fall asleep. And wherever I fell asleep, if it was on the sofa or the chair on the floor, there'd be a wet spot. And this is terrible. I think I've got some kind of problem. I tried to rationalize that by thinking, well, maybe there's something wrong with my bladder. Something I could go see a urologist. They'll give me a pill. Here, take this, and you'll be fine. And I won't even have to mention, oh, yeah, the fact that I drank a couple of gallons of beer. So that was probably about age 17. I began to think that. I can remember trying to drive. I had this old Ford that had so much play in the steering wheel. You could turn it probably 30 degrees and the car would just go in a straight line. It just had so much slack in the steering wheel. And then after that, I'd do some drinking, driving down the road and oversteering. Just to go in a straight line, and it's amazing that I didn't run into anybody. And that was right at age 16 when I first started to drive legally. Those were early signs that something is wrong. At age 18, I had a friend that I'd met who had a bar. Get this, and I heard him ordering his drink, and he ordered a tonic and lime. Wait a minute now. There's no alcohol in that. You ain't got no booze in there. And he said, no. He said, I don't drink. You don't drink? What are you doing here? He was there for some vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere. And he said, no, I don't drink. And so, well, that's interesting. And he and I had some conversation. It turned out he knew my family from years of, he was a lot older than me, and he knew my family from college days or something like that. And so we had a little in common and started talking. And he needed some work done at his house that I was able to do. And so I got some work out of the deal also. And I traveled up out of town to his house one afternoon, and he said that he was in his car, getting in the car, and he said, I'll be back in about an hour. It was almost middle of the day. And I said, where are you headed? He said he was headed to a noon meeting. Oh, yeah. And I knew that he went to AA because he said he didn't drink and kind of put two and two together. And I said, how can I come along? I was just curious. And hey, sure, it's an open meeting. Come on. So I got in the car and went with him, and they were so friendly. Everyone came up, shook my hand, and gave me hugs, and said they were glad to see me and welcomed and keep coming and everything. And I had never been treated like that. And then when the meeting began, the chair asked, this is a desire chip. It's for anyone who has a desire for 24 hours of sobriety. That was how he said it. And I kind of just thought, you know, that'd be cool to stay sober for 24 hours. I had done that a long time. I've got a desire for that. And they said, well, come on. And immediately everybody started clapping their hands. And I did, if I had known that that was going to happen, I wouldn't have said anything. I would have just kept my mouth shut and stayed in my seat. And I didn't want to be the spectacle of attention. So I had to go up and pick up that chip. And
how old were you at that time?
I think I might have been 19 by then. And so I got back in my seat as quick as I could. And I'm sure that I didn't say anything in that first meeting, but I did observe, and I was kind of relieved to hear people share, and they shared of their bottom. They had lost jobs and crashed vehicles and marriages that didn't work out, and so on. The things such that happens to an alcoholic who's still drinking. And I sat there and I said, nope, I've never done that. I've never done that. And hell, I would never do that. And I thought, well, I must not be, what a relief. Well, I'm not as bad as I thought. All I do is piss the bed sometimes. And whew, boy, that's a close one. And so I left feeling better, actually, but kind of in the wrong way. I wasn't reassured or anything. I was more reassured that I'm all right after all. And but I've never really been a person that had a host of friends around me. And that stayed with me, the friendliness of everyone, and kind of missed that when I think about it by myself. And that's what attracted me to come back for another visit. And when I was back at my friend's home, and it would come to be meeting time, I said, well, are you going to one of those meetings? And he said, yeah. Or even if he said, well, I wasn't really, I said, oh, you know, I kind of like, you want to come? And yeah. It's, well, all right, we'll go. And that's how I started going to meetings. And the rest is history. But when we got to the first step, and I realized that every time I drink, I get drunk. And some would say, whether they intended to or not, I would think, well, what else would you drink for? Certainly that is your intention. That's the objective of drinking, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To get drunk, to get out of your mind. And I didn't even realize there were people who don't drink for the purpose of getting drunk. And so that was quite a revelation. And I started to consider, well, maybe I drink too much. And no, surely not. After you get the first one down, then it's okay. So quick. And then they just more start come going down smoother and smoother after that.
When did your life start to get so unmanageable that you thought about quitting drinking forever?
I had career plans through high school. I actually was a little more athletic than I am now. And then I had an accident at age 18. Crashed a motorcycle and broke some bones, and it ended my career plans, and that I'm not going to get what I want.
Were you drinking when you wrecked?
I had started to. I went to a party and had a beer and realized I didn't have any tobacco on me, and so I went to the store to get some tobacco, and I was on the way back to the party and the accident happened. So I'd only had single beer. Not yet, but I had an intention to. And so it ended plans I had for my life. And I think I just threw a big fit. I'm not going to get what I want. And I retreated into drinking because it would help me not feel as disappointed. Well, life is being so cruel. Well, it's not going my way, and so I'll just drink. The hell with everybody, the hell with everything. I'll just drink. And So that's how it went. And I realized not long after that, some of those things that I'd heard people talking about were kind of going on, you know, some of those not yets, things that said, oh, well, they hadn't lost a job. I think I had started to lose jobs because I'd call in instead of show up. And you could get away with that once or twice, but you can't get away with that very much more. And I was pushing it. And so I started losing jobs. And then the only thing to do in that after you lose your job is break in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was doing. And I started going to meetings in the town where I was at. And there was one down the street from the house I live. And it was a large meeting, a lot larger than the one I went to, the first group I'd been with my friend. And I could kind of blend in with them, sit over in this area where nobody ever got called on to speak. And that'd be fine. I could just sit there and listen, which I much preferred to do rather than draw any attention to myself. So I began doing that, and I actually attended quite a few meetings that way. I didn't have to talk, and it was all right. And we'd stay and talk afterwards. We'd go down to the Denny's restaurant, have coffee after the meeting, and I made some pretty good friends in Portland. And that was huge for me. I didn't associate with people anyway. And so that was huge. The more I listened to their stories, not in sharing in the meeting, but the more one-on-one, you know, sitting across from the table, I could ask questions or just, it was back and forth. And that was a more comfortable setting for me, even then. Listening to a speaker in the meeting, I got more out of it that way. And I could hear more that I related to. I just enjoyed the company more. And so I think at the same time, it was also more beneficial. It gave me a desire for what I saw that they had. I recognized humility in people. I didn't know anything about these principles, spiritual principles, talk about my program, but I began to recognize them in other people. I thought that must be what humility is. And cool, that's good to have. And early on, I'd set out trying to duplicate that for myself. And I just screwed up. I couldn't do it. So it would happen later on for me. I'm not going to claim any humility, but if I would just listen and pick it up naturally instead of trying to do it, then I think that's how I could be more like the others and their the things that I admired. And in the process, the days were going along, and I'd be sober another day. I remember one time looking at myself in a mirror, and I used to have these like raccoon eyes for lack of sleep, and my complexion looked better. Well, I guess I had been getting more sleep. I guess I haven't been drinking for this time either. Now let's see, how long has it been? And it had been nearly a month. I'm gonna get to pick up one of those chips. And when I got that first chip, that thing was valuable. And I thought it was silly when I first saw people getting so excited about it whenever I was at first come in. So what? And I didn't drink for 30 days. I could do that. Of course, I couldn't then. And then when I was about to be able to be eligible for my 30-day chip, I was all giddy about it too.
So when you started to realize that you belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous, did you find a sponsor, do some of the things that they suggested you do?
Yeah. My friend Jack He said, I probably shouldn't sponsor because we're friends. He said, but I know somebody that would make a good sponsor for you. Or he was, so he kind of appointed one for me. And sure enough, he was pretty good. Unfortunately, it didn't last very long. He died in a plane crash. But that was my experience early on with my first sponsor. And so I thought, well, that wasn't too hard. That wasn't bad. I guess I could get my own thing sponsored now. And so I set out and followed the instructions that I heard other people giving other people to listen, pick out someone they had that you had liked and ask Smith. So I listened, and there was a guy, Jerry S., in the Shalom Today group in Denton, Texas. And Jerry was, he was in the Army, active duty in the Army. He was a captain, and he was as GI as it gets. And obviously, I am not. You can tell by looking at me. I have long hair, and I ride motorcycles, and it was, it seemed like an opposite, but I liked what he had. I liked the way his life, the shape he had developed. And so I asked Jerry to sponsor me. He said he would. And I was kind of cautious. I thought, now, wait a minute. I hope you don't all of a sudden start treating me like a recruit. tell me to do push-ups or anything. We're through. No, I was right in my estimation of him. He wasn't at all like that. He didn't sponsor me that way at all. And but he was a little bit strict about the steps. He said, you need to get started working the steps. And so we did. And we worked step one, and I don't recall there being any assignment to it other than reading the big book. He assigned me that much to read Bill's story. And I read step one in Bill's story and could just pretty much, so I still hadn't done any of these things yet, but I could see that that's the progression of alcoholism. And I noticed my life was headed in that direction. I still didn't identify with it yet. That came a little bit later on. And the mistake I made was I didn't use my sponsor like my sponsors intended to be used. Call them up, and I didn't pick up the phone and call. And I was still trying to handle things on my own. If I had a tough day, I said, well, it'll be all right. I'll go to a meeting. The meetings are good. They're essential. I couldn't stay sober without it, but there's a whole lot more than just going to meetings. I have learned that in order to stay sober, there's a lot more to it than just going to meetings. And then I was leaving the state, and so I moved, and the town I moved to was rural town, and there wasn't any AA group around. The closest was 20 miles, and the liquor store was equally about the same. And I went to the liquor store instead of starting to the new group. And it started the cycle all over again. At first, I felt guilty, terrible. And I roll the window down and throw the bottle out the window. And as I'm driving back to the house down the highway, and I could see the bottle land in the tall grass over off the shoulder of the road, and I wouldn't get another mile. And I turned, double back, and go back, and I'm walking that ditch with a flashlight, looking for that bottle that I had thrown out the window. It was on me, the obsession for alcohol. It hadn't become a craving yet until I took a drink of it. And as soon as I do that, all right, now I know everything's going to be all right. And then that just opened Pandora's box for I need more, I need more. And the more I drink, it would multiply the desire for it, compound my problems. And then it took another several years before I came back to the program.
Why did you come back?
All those things that heard people say that I hadn't done yet, well, I have now.
Uh-huh.
Probably a few additional things, too. And my health was getting bad. I was in trouble with the law, and I didn't want to die. Man, I realized that might be where I'm headed, either to prison or to the cemetery.
So you started all over again. What did you do differently this time?
I was in this treatment center. Well, see, generally, when I'd go through a treatment center, go through a few days of detox, and after 5 or 6 days of detox, I'd feel so much better. And they'd go, oh, boy, I feel so much better now. I'm going to be all right. Maybe I was just overreacting. So I'd split. I didn't stick around for their program. I'd go ahead and check myself out, go back to my life. And this time I was in a lot of trouble with the law, and man, I need to go through this program. So, and I had this another court date hanging over my head. And so I thought, when I appear before the judge, I'll be able to tell the judge, well, I've been through the program at the treatment center, and I am attending meetings. I had a desire to get my butt out of trouble. I didn't really have a desire for sobriety yet. That comes, but at first, I wanted to try anything I could to avoid going to jail. And so I thought that a little bit of this would certainly look good. And so I stayed and went. After I got out of detox, I stayed in the center and went through their program. And there was a guy coming up there on Wednesday nights talking to us, a guy that from the group that I attend now, and he would share his story. And I had so much weight of the world on my shoulders. I thought, man, the part of the big book where it says the gates of hell had slammed shut, that's how I felt at that time. And with that guy coming up there talking to us, there's a lot of humor in his story. He told it in a funny way, and I laughed. I hadn't laughed in, I don't know how long. It had been a long time. I probably laughed, but only if it was at someone else's expense. But this guy made me laugh, and that felt pretty good. Anyway, then he told me, he said, look, you're due to get out of here pretty soon now, aren't you? I think so. And he gave me his phone number, and he said, if you want to go to a meeting when you get out of here, give me a call. I said, okay. And so I did. I wanted to go to a meeting. I remembered meetings from years ago, and I knew that they would work. It had planted enough of a seed in my mind that I knew that's probably where I better come back to if I have any. I want to stand any chance of staying sober. And that's probably where I better go. And I had begun to put a little bit two and two together that if I drink, I get in trouble. It doesn't seem to be any way to avoid it. Even when I have good intentions and I just want to go home, somehow I end up out in public and the world is out. But I couldn't just go home and drink and get drunk and pass out. Somehow I'd end up in public and in more trouble every time. God, this is insane. And I would use that word, insane. And then I heard more people using the word insane in the context that we use it in the program. And I looked at it, I thought, well, that's exactly what I'm doing. The insanity of picking up that drink, thinking that this time I won't end up in trouble, even though the last dozen times in a row, that is what happened. My actions are insane. My mind is not. My mind is sane, but my actions are insane. And then it would land me in the same boat that a person with an insane mind would be in. And So I realized I have to do something different. And so the day I got out of that treatment center, I gave that man a call, and he came to my house that night, picked me up, and we went to a meeting. And it's really simple as that. And I've been going back ever since. It's just that dang simple.
So it's easy to see that you were powerless over alcohol a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you sharing.
Glad to do it. Thank you.